Today we have the honor of speaking with Gardner Mayor Michael Nicholson, who became mayor of Gardner in July 2020. Mayor Nicholson has been mayor in fiscal years 2021, 2022, 2023, 2024, and 2025. Today, July 1st, 2025, is the start of the mayor's sixth fiscal year as mayor. Good morning, Mayor Nicholson.
Good morning, Warner.
Can you describe briefly what the circumstances were when you took over as mayor in July 2020?
That's a trip down memory lane right there. I had been serving as the town administrator for the town of Rutland, and then transitioned over here to be mayor on July 14th, 2020. We were in the middle still of the COVID shutdown. Things had just started to open up a little bit at the time, and I remember us trying to figure out how to set up chairs for the inauguration while still meeting the COVID restrictions that we had and what was going to be allowed and what was not going to be allowed. I remember on election night, we had people in my garage because we couldn't have people inside. It was just an interesting time. We were still, everyone had to wear masks inside. We could be outside social distanced. It was just one of those times that all of the information was still new. And I remember the day that I took office, I came in and I sat with, then Council President Elizabeth Kaczynskis, who was the acting mayor at the time, in the office. And just for the first two and a half hours, went through everything. We went department by department and issue by issue and press release after press release that came about the pandemic and the restrictions and the upcoming regulations and everything like that. And just went through everything from the last 6 months that previous former city council and then previous acting mayor Jim Walsh had, and then when Councillor Kaczynskis took over as acting mayor, what the two of them had dealt with, even in terms of how things were running in City Hall and the hours that our offices were open. So it was very different than what we have now, for sure. And then the next question was, we didn't know when at the time the COVID vaccines were going to be released. But we know that they were coming, so let's start drilling our mass vaccination events now and figuring out the plans for those now so that when they happen, it's just let's execute, not think through it. And it was one of those things that we really had to just think outside the box a lot because we didn't know what was happening next. But looking back now and what doesn't feel like 5 years later some days and what feels like it's 10 years later other days, I'm really happy that I got to start out my time as mayor in a time that I had to critically think so often and think outside the box so often and really, find that way to creatively come up with the solutions for the ideas that we, the problems we were dealing with, and not just the solution for plan A, but all the way through plan Z. Because I feel like I've carried that with me over the last 5 years, even after the pandemic situation that we were in, with a lot of the different projects and proposals that have come across the desk.
Is the word proactive accurate?
I think it definitely set us up to be proactive for the rest of the time, for sure.
Now, I'd like to ask you a series of questions about needs in Gardner. What changes were made in response to a specific need or an issue? What is the situation like now? And what future improvements do you either anticipate, hope, or strive for? We expect this interview to last less than 18 hours. do we have sleeping bags here and food? There's a lot of good food in Gardner. But seriously, in researching for this interview, I came across 200 items over the past 5 years. And it occurred to me, how is that possible? So I want to delve a little bit into you personally. First of all, you basically are a nerd.
I think my sister would agree with you on that.
You have a work ethic. And this didn't start when you became mayor. This started, my understanding was that you went to Holy Family Academy.
Yep.
And the sisters didn't have too much trouble with you.
We only had one nun left when I was there, Sister Suzanne. And her and I got along very well.
Did she ever slap your fingers?
No, none of that happened while I was there.
So you were well behaved. Now, fast forward all through school, you were in band.
Yep.
You went through high school.
Yep.
Did you have any wild parties at your house when you were in school?
No, I didn't have time for any of that.
You were basically, your head was in the books.
Oh, yeah, all the time. I was really blessed with the opportunities I had at Gardner High because of the number of AP classes I took. I was able to actually finish my two undergraduate degrees in 3 years instead of the normal four, and that opened up opportunities for me to get my master's and certificates. So it was a lot of work, but I always tell the students when I talk to them that, you know, the hard work now pays off later on. So even though, studying and doing things right takes time and it's going to be a lot of effort that you're going to have to put into it and a lot of hours and a lot of late nights, it's all worth it in the end.
Now, since you became mayor, big wild parties at the house?
No, unless you call staying up in the office until 8 o'clock some nights working on the budget a wild time. That's most nights you'll find me here in the office.
And no noise complaints from the mayors?
No, I don't think so.
So kind of a quiet, kind of boring guy who basically spends his time working on stuff for the city.
That's the goal.
I'm not trying to prop you up here, but I'm just trying to put this in context as to how it's possible to achieve things when you've taken an office. Basically, you focused your life on this.
Yeah, you know, it's I never really thought of it until you worded it like that. But yeah, you know, I mean, even my first 2 years as mayor, I was, you know, after work, I would be finishing my law school classes because I graduated with my Juris Doctorate in 2021. And really then it went from shifting to work until class because my classes were all online at the time because of the restrictions and the pandemic and everything, to zooming into class for law school, to really still continuing to work after City Hall closed, but it's work on the city stuff. And it's my staff will tell you that they'll wait, come into work the next day and open their email inbox and be like, well, what were you doing emailing us at 10 o'clock last night? I was like, well, I'm just still getting stuff done at the office. And it's just how things have been.
Now, they say that people who are into history have a lot of insight. Did you study history?
I did. So one of my bachelor's degrees is in history. So I'll just go through that. I have a bachelor's in history, a bachelor's in political science, two undergraduate certificates in international relations and public administration. I have a master's in public policy. All of those are from UMass Amherst. And then I have my Juris Doctor degree from Suffolk University Law School.
Okay, so you got the history, the public policy, you got the legal stuff. Now, is that why you have a clue when it comes to some of these ordinances that you work on and just some of the nitty-gritty that becomes before the city council?
My law degree and my public policy degree definitely help a lot with the ordinance proposals and everything. In fact, I feel like I use them a lot too. I often joke with one of my old professors, Justice Serge Georges, who's one of the SJC justices here in Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, my letters to the city council I take from his opening statements class, and that we learned in law school, if you're going to sell your point, give them the point up front and then explain everything by with it and try to pre-answer every question you get asked. So if you look at the letters that I send compared to some of the letters that went to the city council before, some of them are lengthy, some of them are multiple pages, but I try to preemptively try to answer some of the questions I think I would have on it if I was reviewing it for the first time. So that's kind of something I've taken with me in it for sure. But I also think back to my history degree. My first day of class, I'll never forget Dr. Brian Ogilvie, who's a good friend of mine and a good mentor of mine, started our first class freshman year of UMass in history, saying, you know, it's not the job of a historian to predict the future. The job of a historian is to wait for everything to happen and then explain why it was inevitable to begin with. And looking at our ordinance code, you can see certain things in there that, okay, this was adopted in the 1970s, and this was adopted in the 1990s, and this was adopted in the early 2000s. Look at the effect that it's had, and it was going to have that effect on it going forward. You look in our zoning code that it says there's certain restrictions on senior housing in the city right now, and that was put in the early 80s, late 70s. Well, now what we've seen now is we have a dire need for senior housing. So looking through those different ordinance codes that we have and kind of taking that perspective from the history side of things, but then taking the legal public policy side of things and using that lens to look forward, I kind of use my educational background to get the full holistic picture of it.
So would you say that it helps to know the history of Gardner, to know what has been done poorly, what could be done better, and has that been a foundation for some of your proposals?
Of course. I mean, you always need to know the history of the community that you live in, because you're going to build off of a foundation no matter what. No one's going to be redigging a new foundation to build a house that just needs a new patch of siding put on it. What you have to do in the end is build with the situation you're in to get the better project, because you can't build from the ground up if you don't know where you're starting. So having that historical knowledge, having that institutional background, and having that mentality of you're here to make the community the best it is, not replace the community that you were in, is really what's going to set you up for success.
Financially, the city of Gardner's in a pretty good spot right now.
We are. I'm really happy about that.
Why?
We've taken a very careful approach with what we've been doing with our spending, with our finances, and really following the policies that we have in place, too. A lot of people may not realize that for the past 8 or so years, I actually was one of the projects I worked on when I was the executive aide in this office, we've made financial policies that the administration, the executive branch of the city's government has to follow. Now, that includes when things get put up before the city council, how our spending goes, what projects get what type of funding, everything from there. And we follow those policies, and that's what gets us to where we are today. We have to be very careful, because there's many communities in Massachusetts that are looking for things like a Prop 2.5 override, that are looking for substantial budget cuts because they can't afford certain things right now. And many in our area are in that spot now, and we've been able to avoid that here because we take that careful approach. And really, you know, it's not just double-crossing your T's and double-dotting your I's, but also making sure that, yeah, we're not guessing that the revenue is going to be too high in the budget. We're not asking for more than what we need. We're making sure that our one-time funds are going to one-time projects and working towards that type of cyclical look at things, because you need to be conservative in your finances, otherwise you set yourself up for failure.
Tell me about your 94% rule.
So the 94% rule is what we do with revenue. And our guess is in the revenue. So if you look at the budget that I have on the mayor's page on the city's website, one of those has our revenue, and there's a section of that portion of the budget that's called local receipts. Our local receipts are any revenue that we receive that's not taxation. That's everything from, not real estate or property taxation. So that's the marijuana tax that we receive. That's the fees that we collect on the permits that people pull, that's the fines we issue on tickets we give out, that's user fees for things like the Greenwood Pool. There's a lot in there. There's about 75 to 80 different subsets of what we call local receipts. And that's, again, just any revenue that we receive that's not just regular taxation. And what we do with that is we take the average of the last 3 years that we've taken in that specific account. So I want to know on motor vehicle excise tax, if rather than guessing that, oh, I'm going to make the same that I did last year, we'll take a look back on the previous 3 years, find what the average are on those 3 years, and then take 94% of that. And that's what I'm putting in the budget that we're going to be getting in revenue this year. Whether or not I know it's going to go higher or go lower, depending on what the line item is, if it goes lower, we may go 90%. But 94%, we will not go higher than that on a revenue line item to make sure that we're setting ourselves up, that we have at least a buffer in our revenues for the next year.
So it does give you a cushion, because if you do get in the 100%,
yeah,
then there's that extra 6% that you didn't plan on that'll cover. There's always something unexpected it'll cover.
Correct, yeah.
So from a physical perspective, the money comes into the city.
Yeah.
Who handles the money coming in?
So money coming into the city goes through the city auditor's office. Money coming out of the city goes through the city treasurer's office. So that's the check and the balance. And those two departments are overseen by the city council, but they work very closely with my office. As I propose the budget to the city council, any money orders that go before the city council have to initiate in the executive branch and then be put to the city council for their review and approval. So we work very closely with each other on making sure our finances stay stable, stay afloat, stay where we need them to be. So that's kind of how things work there. And then when it gets to the city auditors, there's various different state laws that dictate this funding has to go to this type of account. 95% of what we take in, actually it's probably closer to 98% of what we take in, has to go to what we call the general fund. Now, the general fund is this big bubble term, if you will, that just says it goes to funding the city's budget that was approved by the city council in the last year. So every time you hear the state unrestricted general government aid, that's the money that we take in from the lottery each and every year that the state gives us on what's called our cherry sheet. That's just a fancy word for the state aid paper that they send us every year and saying this is how much you're getting in state aid. That goes to the general fund. Anytime someone pays a bill to the city, that goes to the general fund, unless it's restricted to different various accounts. So, for instance, if you pay your water bill in the city, we have a water enterprise account. Same thing with the sewer enterprise account and the various enterprise accounts that we have. Those are special accounts that are set up for people who are paying for a specific service that not everyone receives, and that's why they also have to be separate. And that's where the other 2% comes into play, that most of it will go to the general fund unless it's restricted to those very specific accounts. But anything from the state, anything from anything that's paid to the city that's not enterprise related, anything that comes into the city in just a general check that's not restricted goes into the general fund.
All right. Now, when the money goes out, there's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually an online checkbook.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can find anything that's paid for out of the city right on the city's website. We want to be as transparent as possible. We don't want anyone to think that there's any confusion, anything going on with the city's finances. So we want to make that as open and transparent to the public as possible, so that's why we put that on the city's website.
Okay, so here's my question. You come into office.
Yep.
And then something happened that never happened before. Once, twice, three times, four times, perfect federal audits. Why?
Because when you're dealing with the taxpayers' money, you want to make sure people feel confident in the work that you're doing. And that's the goal for us here, is that we want people to, one, know what we're doing in City Hall on their behalf each and every day, but also, two, that we're doing what we need to do with the investments that they're making into their community. And you have to treat it like you're a person overseeing someone's investment account. You want to build a city that people are proud and happy to call their home. And that's what we're doing here. So we'll always make sure we're following everything to the T that we can.
But what did you do differently so that it was flawless? What's the process that's different?
Well, first off, I want to say it's not just me. Our city auditor, our city treasurer, our purchasing director, and our city assessor, that's our finance team here with the five of us who meet together monthly to go over everything, to make sure things are going the way they're supposed to go. And then just having open, honest conversations when we see something that, you know, could potentially be flagged, preemptively addressing it now. Whether it be paperwork needs to be submitted in a more timely manner, so we update the policies and procedures when it comes to reporting for grants and reimbursements and things like that. All of those things are conversations that we've had, and it's the team that we really have here at City Hall.
Now, you use the word preemptive, which is another word for proactive.
Yeah.
So here we go again. We're back to being proactive. So, I mean, is that the central theme? Is just taking care of problems before they happen?
Yeah, because if you can deal with it, it's 10 times easier to deal with a problem before it happens than after. So we always try to pre-guess what any problem. In fact, one of the questions we ask in almost every meeting we have is, what problems do you foresee that could happen with this? And let's try to address those now so we don't have to later.
All right. So then you have less problems later.
Exactly.
All right. So we're beginning to uncover how you do things here a little bit. So when it comes to audits, there's also third-party audits that come in.
Yep.
And check on the city. How does the city do with those?
Well, those are required actually by federal law, and we actually have to send those audits to the White House Office of Budget Management to make sure that they meet their minimum standards and qualifications and generally accepted accounting practices is the term that they use. I mean, we've cleared all of those as well, too. They'll make suggestions here and there in terms of, you know, update your timestamp here or consider going digital here. But we've cleared all of the we haven't gotten any, you know, findings other than small recommendations here and there. In some years, we haven't even gotten those. It's been pretty good. And again, it's the same thing. It's a testament to the team that we have here and the process that we've established.
So if you were to sum it up, would you say it's accurate to say that by attempting to avoid future problems, you avoid future problems?
Oh, yeah. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And I think it's the old adage that's with that, too. So why not make the plan ahead of time?
Now, you came into Gardner.
Yep.
Tell us about the situation, the condition of the business community when you came into town. What were the vacancies like when you took over as mayor in 2020?
The businesses that we had in 2020 had been longstanding businesses, and people were, you know, had invested in the city for years. You look at the longstanding businesses that we had at the time, like John's Sports Shop, the Velvet Goose, the Paramount Cafe, Lakin's Fine Children's Apparel. You look at things in South Gardner, like the Gardner Cinemas, and every, the other places that are all around the city right now that had been, longstanding for years, or some cases even decades. And then you look at the places that had been new at the time. The 99 restaurant was new at the time. But there were a lot of vacancies, like you just said. Things were struggling. You look at Timpani Crossroads back in 2020. They had most of the buildings were vacant at the time, if not still under construction, because of those vacancies. Downtown, when we established our vacant storefront improvement districts in the Timpani Boulevard corridor and in the downtown, we had around 18 vacancies in the Timpani Boulevard corridor and around 46 in the downtown area. And that was in 2022, let alone in 2020. So we really made a focused effort in trying to bring businesses into the area and, you know, marketing ourselves and advertising ourselves to the broader community outside. And I think we've done a good job at that so far. You look, are there still vacancies around the city? Of course there are. Are we doing everything we can to try to fill those? Yes. But if you look, the numbers are substantially lower than where they were before. We're down to only two in the Timpani Boulevard corridor out of the 18 that we originally had. And in the downtown area, we're down from the 46 to around 16. So there's still more than we'd like to see, but we're in the process of filling those.
Now, when it comes to business vacancies in a city, there's always going to be businesses that go out, and there's going to be businesses that come in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, has your strategy simply been to get more businesses in than go out, so you're keeping ahead of it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's anyone's strategy, is to try to bring more businesses in than those that leave. And not everyone's going to last, and not everyone's going to stay, but at least they gave it a shot to try us out here in the city. And for various reasons, some have, you know, some have left, some have closed, some have relocated, but for the by and large, we're still at a net gain from where we were.
All right, so let's talk about specific locations: Timpani Plaza,
mm-hmm.
Timpani Crossroads, downtown Gardner, other areas of the city, the small business support that you've given, the developer support committee that you have, so that when businesses that are interested in the city come in, they're actually shown, you know, which departments they should go to get started, and what programs specifically, since you've been here, have been implemented to help businesses, like during and after COVID, and, you know, your vacant storefront program and all that. I mean, there's really a lot that you've done, and it's hard to put it all in a short period of time, but how can you sum it up in a nutshell as to what you've done?
Well, I think in the nutshell, the one word you have to come up with is partnership. And because when these businesses are taking a chance on the community, that's exactly what they're doing. They're taking a chance. They're investing. They're hoping things work out for that business. And you want to set them up for success. That's in the end. Sometimes it's been cold calling businesses to see if they come in. So, for instance, you've mentioned Timpani Plaza. Aldi, Five Below, and Chipotle have a partnership agreement that if one does a market analysis study somewhere, then they share that data with those other companies that are in there. So that triangle agreement that they have there, you're marketing to one, you're actually marketing to three. And when these businesses come in, yes, their success is their own. Their relocation is their job, but we partner with them. Sometimes it's cold calling to say, we want you to take a chance on us. And that's what happened with Aldi. Sometimes it's making sure that when they're going through the permitting process and the zoning process, we're working with them to understand the complex situations that are there so that they can have the easiest time they're going through it. And that's what we've seen in a lot of those properties that are there. Timpani Crossroads is full now, when it was all but the 99 was vacant in 2020 when we started there too. And again, sometimes that's just working through the paperwork. Sometimes that's finding people or connecting people or maybe reaching out. I don't know how many letters and phone calls I've made to different businesses saying, hey, we've got this location in Gardner. I think you should give it a shot. So that's been a lot of the pre-work that we do to try to get people in. And then when they're going through the process of when they're starting out, being like, how can we help you so that you start out successful? But, you know, during the COVID-19 pandemic, we issued small business grants and microenterprise grants and what we called shuttered business support grants, and that's utilizing some of the federal funding that we received for COVID relief to help our business community. Our shuttered businesses were our restaurants, the movie theater, and those businesses that had to be closed longer than other businesses during the pandemic just because of the style of business that they had. Our microenterprise was for businesses that had five or less employees, because those were some of the smaller mom and pop shops that were struggling the most. And then our small business grants were those that had 50 or less employees, that again just had to be had some type of economic shutdown. And that went to paying for things like you still had to have electricity, you still have to have heat, you still had to keep your cable and your internet subscriptions going forward. So we helped cover those while they were shut down, so that they could use that money to then boost themselves back up when they were able to open up again to recoup their sales that they lost during that time period before. So there's a lot that we were able to do all around the city, not just in the downtown. We've really made a lot of investments in Gardner, and I'm really proud of that.
All right. So you come into office, and you know that there were a lot of blighted or unused city properties. Properties just sitting there costing the city money because, for example, with School Street School, the police department was out there, the fire department was out there when kids would break in. Waterford Street School was unused. So much was unused, no tax money coming in. So with respect to Prospect, School Street School, the Greenwood Indoor Pool Building, the Garbos Metal Site, the Mill Street Corridor, the DPW salt shed that was falling apart. I remember you doing an update from that shed one time. It was just falling apart. Improvements at City Hall, the Park Street substation that showed the just a horrible look coming into town. And then what's been done with the Waterford Street School to make it a community center to actually help the needs of the Gardner CAC, the Senior Center, and various nonprofits. Tell me from the beginning what your thought process was and kind of take us through that a little bit.
I mean, the main thought process that we had was I didn't want the city to be our next absentee landlord. And if we were putting this pressure on the private sector, especially with the ordinance that was co-sponsored by myself and now Council President Tyros at the time to really update our blighted nuisance and problem property ordinance, we should be holding ourselves to the same standard. So we did a big effort to put a lot of buildings out for sale that we were just sitting on, not just buildings, but also land. There was land on Chelsea Street that we owned that we took in tax title years ago that we'd never done anything with. Prospect Street School had been vacant for years. It's now currently under construction. If you drive by, you can see that the National Grid has installed the temporary electricity in there for the new condo units that Molina Realty's currently putting together over there. School Street School, we had the announcement that we've obtained CDBG funding for its demolition. The Greenwood Indoor Pool, that demo is going to be happening imminently within the next month or two over at that location. The Garbos Metal Site is currently under negotiation right now with the GRA and a developer that we'll soon be able to announce soon too. The Mill Street Corridor, that same developer actually has not just the Garbos Metal Site under negotiation, but also the former S. Bent property under negotiation. Again, those are all fluid situations that are there. But it's stuff that we're all working on right now because, again, we should be holding ourselves to the same standard that we're holding everyone else to and setting the example with that, too. The DPW salt shed, if you drive by Manka Drive right now, you'll see the area has been cleared, the site work's been done, and we'll be going out to bid for the full construction of that imminently. The Gardner Airport, that was all federal grant-funded, so there really wasn't much city funding that went into that. But the state and federal government pushed in millions and millions of dollars to get that back up and running right now. That's how we're actually able to secure additional programming over there through MIT and their drone program. So they actually train at the Gardner Airport through their classes on drone classes through MIT. But that was a full reconstruction. It was the first time the runway had had any type of pavement since it was originally installed in the 1980s. So if you picture, if your road hadn't been paved any time since the 1980s, what that would be like. Now imagine landing a plane on something like that. So that was, you know, a big investment that we made. Over there. City Hall, we've had some smaller improvements. So, for instance, we moved the public restrooms to the first floor rather than where they were previously in the stairwells. And the reason being for that is that up until we moved them back to the first floor on the other side of the City Hall Rotunda, they weren't handicap accessible. You'd have to go down a flight of stairs to a stair landing to get to the bathrooms, and then use another set of stairs to get into the bathrooms themselves once you open the bathroom door. So now we've made it so that they're fully accessible here to the public. We've also made different upgrades throughout the building that are smaller in terms of just increasing access to the public in terms of our online permitting, so that you don't have to come to City Hall if you don't have to. You can do that from the comfort of your own home. The Park Street substation, I think the Park Street Park is one of the nicest views that we have in the city, and it took an area that was literally bound by barbed wire in our downtown and just dead looking and turned it into one of the nicest walking spots, or spot to just sit by the water and, you know, have a picnic, have a bite to eat, just sit down and just think in one of the benches and just watch the water and just have a relaxing time over there, where it connects to the new bike trail that's behind the Greenwood Pool, through the newly paved road on Crystal Lake Drive, and then through the bike trail that goes around the cemetery out through the Park Street area by Eaton Street. That's one of the, I think, nicer walks that we have in the city right now, too. And then the amount of work that's been done over at the community center is substantial. When this building has its chance to open later on this year, I'm very excited to see how people utilize the facility to its fullest there. The CAC and Growing Places that currently have two leases with the city for their spaces over there have done a ton of investments and a ton of work in there to outfit their spaces that are there. It's really been great to see how much progress has been made inside that building, and I'm looking forward to seeing that open later this year.
Now, starting here in fiscal year 6, you're doing something with Helme Sauter School. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I just put a proposal before the city council to put the Helen May Sauter School up for sale. The city council will have to vote on that at one of their upcoming meetings. But again, it's the same thing. We don't have the resources to maintain that building on our own right now with the buildings and facilities that we have a lot of backed maintenance on our own to do that. So I would like to put it out for a request for proposal or RFP. What that does is people submit not only their price to buy the building from us, but also what their intended use of the building is. It can be anything from office space to housing to anything in between, but they need to submit a detailed plan to us as to what they'd like to do with the building. And then I'll appoint a committee to do a preliminary review of everyone who puts in those submissions for that building. And then they'll issue their final recommendation to me, and I'll have a chance to review not only their recommendations, but all of their final proposals that were submitted. And then after all of that, then we'll take a look at what the price offerings are too. So through the RFP process, we're able to look at quality versus price and get the best outcome for the city that way. And in doing so, really take a chance to look at that process that we have there and make it the best possible outcome for the city. So I am hopeful that we'll be able to do something with Helen May Sauter soon and see the best that we can do to save that building, one, so we don't end up with a situation like School Street School or the Greenwood Pool, where it's put off so much on the back burner that it just falls in on itself, but also gets us to a point where it increases the opportunities for our residents out there, be it even residentially or through the services offered if it goes to some type of commercial use.
And you're also being reasonable up front. You're suggesting a minimum bid of $300,000, even though there was an appraisal of $765,000, recognizing what needs to be done to make it a viable business venture for someone.
Absolutely. There's so much work that has to be done in that building. Anytime you take a school building and convert it into anything other than a school, there is significant investment that has to be made, let alone in a building that was built in the early 1900s. So that's something you just have to be reasonable. And that goes back to our phrase partnership that we mentioned earlier, is yes, it's great for the city to sell something. Yes, it's great for us to get that sale revenue. But it's also better for us to get the tax revenue long term over the next 20, 30, 50 years. And the way we do that is making sure someone's set up for success to actually repair the building and get it up to its most optimal use, so that we have that longer term investment and not just that one time money that we have right now.
All right. So talking about blighted properties, they weren't just city-owned properties. There were a lot of private-owned properties that were really in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about that Stewart Street factory. We're talking about 25 Main Street. We're talking about the Garbos building, 42 to 52 Main Street, Bank of America, etc. So what did you do? Make a list and reach out? Or how did it come to be that all of this progress happened in the last 5 years when it didn't happen before? What was different?
And, you know, it was kind of similar to the same process we did with getting businesses in here, too. I remember I had actually sat down with a developer who's now very settled in the city about wanting to buy their first property in Gardner, and it was actually the Stewart Street property. And I remember being like, that's great. Have you looked at any of the other properties in Gardner? And I actually gave him a list. And what happened was, when I first took office, there was a day that myself, the building commissioner, and Colin Smith, who used to work in my office, just took a drive around the city, and we just looked at every building that we thought had problems with it, or was vacant, or was being underutilized. So we had that list ready, and that's how, you know, kind of what started the wheel.
So you made a list and worked the list.
Exact, kind of, yeah. Kind of. Now, there were some properties here that people had already been looking at on our local. And I got to give Empire Management and Empire Properties a big shout out and the renovations they did for their own building. And then carrying that across the street to the old Bank of America building and some of the other properties in the city. But other than that, when we were talking to outside people, it was honestly just working the list, like you said. And figuring out how we can best get that happen. Now, there was a couple things we did to help incentivize that. We utilized a lot of our ARPA funding to do sign and facade grants. So if a new business came in, we matched up to a certain percentage of the new signage that they bought for their business that was put on the building. None of our grants, I want to say, too, were 100% funded, because we wanted to make sure people had their own stake in the game, too. So we, you know, provided some funding for the new signage for the businesses. We provided some funding for new facades for the building to spruce them up so they looked like they had life in it, so that when someone was looking, do I want to put my business here? The question was, yeah, that looks nice, not like, I think I'm going to look somewhere else because that doesn't look like the nicest place for me to put my business. So we utilized a lot of our funds for that. And then lastly, we have our vacant storefront revitalization districts that we've approved with the state, where there's certain financial incentives from the state if a business opens up in a storefront that's been vacant for more than 12 months. The state just changed that last year to more than 6 months to incentivize more people coming in, because they've seen the success of this program in places like Gardner. So we're looking forward to continuing some of those programs here too. We don't have any money appropriated right now for the sign and facade program, but we are still continuing with the vacant storefront program and finding new creative ways to help incentivize buildings being spruced up so that they come in, attract businesses a lot better.
When a city like Gardner has success in revitalizing private buildings, do other developers hear about that and say, hey, I heard that so-and-so had success in Gardner? Does that prompt people to check you out?
Absolutely. I was shocked when we had the first couple buildings happen, how many people then reached out after that. It was like a frenzy in the office for like a month. So it definitely has brought increased attention to us here in Gardner. One of the things that you know, we're looking to do right now then is, how do we make it easier for them to come in? Now that we've had people come in for the last 5 years, working with them and talking with them and seeing like what could we do better? And that's brought about some of the changes you've seen recently in terms of some of the ordinance proposals that we've put forward, some of the ways that we operate with our online permitting system, and just making things so we can be as open for business as possible.
Now, you have something set up in the city, so if someone reaches out, there's a group of people that they talk to first before they spend a lot of money doing different things. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's set up in the city's ordinance. It's called the Development Review Committee. So if someone wants to come in and do some type of big development, be it a housing development or a new business opportunity or an expansion, there's public meetings that are held and posted, and the Development Review Committee sits down. It's made up of various city staff from the various different oversight departments that have permits or oversight regarding the different projects that people are overseeing so that they can get all of their questions answered all at once. And it's not like, oh, well, I'm going to start here, but I don't know where to go next, and I don't know what's going to ask this, and I don't know how to oversee that. We lay everything out for you right up front so you know your full process, A to B to C to all the way to the end of the alphabet, right at the get-go, so it's as easy as possible and as transparent as possible.
And that way, it's a positive takeaway, and they're more apt to follow through.
Exactly. 1,000%.
All right. So let's talk about recreation and open space. And before I do that, I'd be remiss to not talk about how you've made actually downtown Gardner look better since you've been here. I mean,
thanks.
I mean, sidewalks and paving, right? I mean, that's part of it. But what else in downtown? There's the recreation part, too.
Yeah, I mean, the sidewalks and paving were all done as part of a water infrastructure project to help make it so that we had opportunities for more businesses to come in. But it did help us in the long term, too, and making sure that we had a walkable downtown. We had places for people to go. So, for instance, the Orpheum Park, which is going to have some sprucing up this summer. But now, you know, it went from the grass lot, just where the movie theater used to be, to now where the fountain is with the flowers and some benches. The Mackey Park, you know, while that still has some work that has to be done for it, is better than just a plain grass lot that we just had to mow and do nothing with over the course of the years it had been since the Mackey block got torn down. Monument Park has had a lot of upgrades there. We're partnering with Gateway Fiber to provide free internet for Monument Park in terms of for Wi-Fi for people who just like to get out and get some work done in the sun or sit down and watch the band concerts or increase the opportunities that we have there moving forward. There's a lot that's happened in the downtown, even just the sprucing up with the flowers. Now, the flower pots came from a lot of people came to us saying that they liked the way that downtown Leominster looked. So we took a drive down downtown Leominster and saw those flower pots. Mayor Mazzarella and I talk very regularly, so we talked about where he bought those plastic flower pots. So we went, we talked to them, we used some grant funding that we got for beautification services, got the flower pots, and the intent was to originally put them out for the parade that we had for our centennial celebration. And it really has taken off from there, too. And I really can't thank our volunteer flower pot committee, who's now really just become the flower committee, because it's not just the flower plots, but the boxes that we have at, you know, Bullnose Park, at the different large planters that we have around the city. So our city councilor, Judy Mack, Amy Levasseur from our purchasing office, Megan Grace from the human resources office, and Katie Jablonski from my office, who really took that program and ran with it. And they look beautiful, and I, you know, very proud about how that looks, just to improve the curb appeal so people want to get out and walk around.
See, and I think there's something that you haven't mentioned, and that's the unintended positive consequences of encouraging volunteerism. Recently, a publication cited Gardner as being the kindest city in Massachusetts, number 96 in the country. Part of it's because you focused on people.
Well, yeah, people are policy. I've said that from the start. That's a tagline I took from my internship I had with former Governor Baker and former Lieutenant Governor Polito. And that was actually the theme of their going away get-together that they had after they left office, was the people are policy is the main foundation that you have to have when you're in here. Every decision you make, every proposal you put forward, every thought that you have when you're sitting in these chairs in City Hall has a person aspect to it, behind it. Even if it's something as similar as selling Helen May Sauter, and I'll use that as an example because that's something we just talked about, there are people who live in the neighborhood who want to know that the building is not going to fall in, that any proposed uses of the property are not going to be a detriment to the neighborhood. There are people who are waiting for housing opportunities, that if a housing opportunity goes in there, that maybe that's somewhere that they could live. There are people that are looking for employment opportunities, that if a business goes in there or there's office space in there, maybe that's where they'll work. And you have to look at all of those things from a people perspective, and that's how you're successful on the job.
All right, now you got to tell me about the Dane Arnold phone call on Orpheum Park. You saw something, you call him, you said, hey, can we do this here?
Yeah, it was with the fountain for sure. That was the first part. Before we had the tree there that had died. And it was really just a space that there was, it was underutilized. And it's one of those things that you have to have that almost out-of-the-box vision with it and be like, all right, let's sit down, let's get to what's unattainable, and then meet in the middle to the attainable. And we talked about everything from swings to vines on the fence that was there to everything in between. And then we're like, you know what would look nice? A raised flower bed, but let's put something in the middle. Let's do a fountain to add some type of water feature to it. And that's been one of the, I think of the beautification efforts we've made in the downtown, that's one that we get compliments on weekly, even to this day, and it's been there for 3 years now.
You ever talk to your department heads after the workday is over, after 4:30?
I try my best not to, but yeah, that does happen sometimes. But, you know, it's just, I do thank them for understanding too, and then sometimes, but I do my best not to bother them outside of work hours, but that does happen.
But I bet you talk to public safety folks after hours.
Oh, all the time. All the time. I'm on the fire department has a notification system, and I'm on all of the, that sends a text message out to every firefighter whenever there's a significant call, a recall, a fire. So I get all of those to my work cell phone, just to be able to see what they're doing there too, and just check in too. And if there's certain incidents or accidents that happen in the city, I will always be in conversation.
And then you went out with DPW in the middle of the night.
Yeah. I went out. I try to go once a year on things with the various departments that we have. So I go out once a year plowing. This was the first year I did the overnight shift before I had done the day shift. But there's a difference in the day versus the night. I would have never expected the DPW prefers the night shift when it comes to plowing because there's less people on the road. But I didn't get to see that until I did the night shift to the 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. Plow route. I've gone on different search warrants with the police department at various times of the day and night to see what the situations that they have to go through. It's all things that if you don't put yourself into that perspective and gain that perspective, and I'm not playing police officer and I'm not playing plow driver and I'm not playing firefighter, but I do want to see what it is that they deal with so that when we're making decisions on we need new fire trucks, we need new firearms for the police department, we need new radio equipment, we need this, we need that, we need a new plow truck, you can see why. And it just puts that into a different perspective in your mind, because I'll agree with them that they'll need it, but the explaining why is something that you gain a whole different viewpoint on when you're actually there. They say the picture's worth 1,000 words, but the experience is worth the full book.
Well, you want to know where they're coming from.
Exactly.
Now, at one point in your life, you worked as a substitute teacher.
I did.
So you know all about kids and their needs. So when it comes to recreation and open space, you were also familiar with what Gardner was lacking.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about Bailey Brook Park and that idea and some of the efforts in bringing forward a space for, you know, younger kids.
You know, I think Bailey Brook Park is one of the perfect examples of getting input from the community so that the product in the end is the best outcome for the community as a whole. When I took office, I inherited a plan for Bailey Brook Park that included a soccer field in the area, basketball courts, and you know, some walking trails. And I still remember we had a community meeting in the parking lot of Bailey Brook Park where the residents of the street got to come out and we had a conversation with them and said, you know, what is it you want to see? What are your concerns? There were concerns about soccer tournaments on the weekends and whistles and how close they were to the houses that were on Leo Drive. And how do we make it so that we could fix things moving forward so that we could have something that's optimal for the people who live there but also increases the recreational opportunities that were there for the city. And that's how we landed on a disc golf course. We had a lot of demand for people who were looking for disc golf as a new upcoming sport that isn't really disruptive because there's no league. I mean, there's leagues for it, but it's nothing that you're going to have these big whistles for. It's nothing that you're going to have these. And it was something that could follow along the walking path that was there. So that was something that was there. We did a review of all of our city playgrounds, and we saw that all of our playgrounds were actually graded for ages 5 and older. And we didn't have anything for our younger population that, while they could use the swings and everything else in the other playgrounds, is that really the safest thing for someone who's under the age of 5 or a toddler or things like that? So we built our first playground rated for people in that that time frame and age frame to really get the best possible outcome that's there. And there was a lot of good that came from that. And then there were concerns about the basketball noises in the neighborhood too. But they asked for pickleball. So we were like, all right, well, let's change the plan from basketball to pickleball. And that's how we took all of that community feedback that we got and made one of the best parks and playgrounds that we have in the city. And I'm really proud about that.
Now, the last 5 years, there have been...
Can we take one quick timeout? I just got to deal with this situation.
Sure.
Yes. If I remember where I put it. Yes, I did. Okay. One quick second. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay.
Alma, how are you doing?
Sorry about that. I was looking for a letter.
Oh, that's all right. Let's see. That's quite all right.
Yeah. All right.
So, just noted for the public, we're in the process of doing this interview. And guess who is more important? A constituent. So without revealing any confidences, the constituent was looking for some information that was important to that constituent.
Yeah, yes, there was a constituent that just came in. Thank you for taking the break in the interview that just need to make sure that the constituent got the information that was there. And it was just a quick in and out, but it's one of those, if you know, someone takes the time to come into the office, we want to make sure that we take care of them.
And that's the norm here.
Yeah.
So sometimes you hear crazy stuff on social media about not paying attention to constituents or some of that nonsense. But I just saw it firsthand how it was more important for you to get that letter out. I mean, that could have waited.
Yeah.
But that was more important because that's who you serve.
Yeah.
You exactly. Don't serve the media. You serve the public.
Yeah.
So that just is very telling right there for those who are paying attention. So now the issue, aesthetic improvements in downtown Gardner in the city, making the city look good. What was it then, what was it now, and what specifically, we've covered a little bit of it, but what specifically have you put forward in the city?
Well, for instance, we paved more roads in the city in the last 5 years than we have in any five-year period in the city's recent history, going back to as far as the 80s. We paved 25% of the city's roads. We've got 100 miles of roads. We paved 25 miles of that. Is there always more we can do? Absolutely. And I understand that when you say you paved 25 miles of road in the city and a quarter of the city has been paved, that's great, but my street wasn't one of the ones that's paved. I understand that, and I completely get it. The cost of paving a mile of street right now is about $1.5 million per mile, which is a lot. The funding that we receive from the state through Chapter 90 every year is helpful, but we've been receiving the same amount every year since 2012. So there's only so much we can do with what we have. We have supplemented that money each and every year on the city side with free cash. I always put up a minimum 10% of free cash to paving every year. And then at the end of the year, if we have anything left over in the extra at the end of the year in our free cash appropriations that are use or lose by the end of the fiscal year, the remaining of that I've always put forward in paving. And we saw that just recently when I put up an additional $105,000 for paving funds in the city. But again, when you're at $1.5 million per mile, you really have to prioritize what you can do. There's only so much you can do each and every year. So we're going to continue doing what we can. We've started to find new ways to fund paving projects via grant funding, like we saw over with Crystal Lake Drive through the Mass Trails grant because it connects to the bike trail, through the infrastructure upgrades that we had, as we saw in the downtown area through the water infrastructure project. And we'll continue doing that moving forward. Same thing with the sidewalks. If there's a road that has a sidewalk on it, we'll always try to do them both at the same time. We're going to be seeing that this year with Elizabeth Street, where we're doing the waterline replacement project there now, too. So we're looking at repaving and doing the sidewalks on that street. We talked about the facades and the signage downtown, but we've also instituted a new wayfinding plan that's going to be a part of our final master plan document that we have for the city. On where we can improve our signage around the city to help people get to where they want to go, and really working with our DPW to make sure we have the adequate signage that we need through Doug Monroe and his lines and signs division of the DPW. They're really great.
We talked earlier about how you're often here in the office working your tail off, and one of the things you focused on was cleaning up the books. And you went to the city council and you said, you know what, we've got this loan order that's we borrowed something over this, and we got X amount here, and that's sitting there, and we got this one over here. Tell us about that, cleaning up the books.
Yeah, it was just, like Zach, you just said, cleaning up the books. There were a lot of loan orders that the city had taken out over the last 15 years that had never been closed out, but the projects were done. So working with the city auditor's office, we cleaned them up. We got the loans closed out, and then I guess we just took them off of our balance sheet that we had to carry forward. And really just made it so that it was easier for us when we went through our auditing process. We cleaned up our own balance sheet so that we didn't have to carry that liability anymore. And it was something that just needed to be done and had been put on the back burner. And we finally just got it off the back burner and did the job.
So no more sloppy.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. That's one way to put it. But it was just we realigned our focuses. How's that?
All right. So you have a budget process.
Yes.
How come the increases in Gardner are smaller than other similar cities?
I really think it's because of the 94% rule that I have that we've talked about earlier. It's that you have to find ways to live within your means and be conservative. And if you get surprised in the end, great. If not, then you've already set yourself up with the right barriers and protections that you need that you're not going to be too surprised and you can handle any unexpected expenses that will come along the way.
All right. Now, are the City Hall employees satisfied with the quality of the toilet paper?
I remember that interview. Yes, they are. That was more just saying that the state does have bidding laws that we have to follow and different purchasing laws. So, for instance, Chapter 30B of the general laws requires us not to buy brand name items. So you're not going to see Kleenex and you're not going to see different other brand name items that are here. You're going to see a lot of generic things from there, and that's why we have the contract that we have with WB Mason that we went out to bid for and obtained with them to make sure that we're meeting all of these procurement requirements, and those are all things that are outlined by the general laws.
Ooh, well, I'm just using it as an example of how cheap you are with the taxpayers' money. Man, the taxpayers like that. Give me some other examples of how you're kind of cheap when it comes to buying stuff.
I mean, it's just, you have to be careful. There's laws that we have to follow, and there's people who we are accountable to, and we remember that in every purchase and decision that we make. So
you got a pretty good purchasing agent, too.
Yeah, yeah, honestly, our purchasing department's very strong. Josh Cormier, our director, and Amy Levasseur, the executive assistant in there, do an excellent job with the work that they do.
And the auditor doesn't let a thing go past him.
No, every contract that we have in the city, I'll put it this way, every contract that we have in the city and every change order that may come with that contract has six signatures that are put on that document to make sure everyone is checking everything. It starts with the department head who's overseeing that project to make sure that it meets their standards for what they actually need. Then it goes to the purchasing agent to make sure that anything with that contract complies with all required laws that we have to follow in terms of the general laws, in terms of bidding, in terms of getting quotes, in terms of everything like that. Once it's signed off from the purchasing agent, it then goes to the city solicitor to make sure that everything in that contract meets all other legal requirements outside of those that are overseen by the purchasing department. Then it goes to the city auditor, who makes sure that the funding source for that project is there and makes sure everything is done correctly and the money is there and the money is already secured. After it goes to the city auditor, it goes to the vendor. The vendor then makes sure that everything that's in that contract meets with the requirements that they're supposed to go to. And after the vendor signs it, it comes to me. And then I am the final signature on that one to make sure that everything meets the goals of the city as a whole and that everyone's checked off everything and everything's done the right way. So there's six steps that actually go through to make sure every contract that the city is signing and every change order to that contract that may come is all done the correct way. The process is done. The money is there. The money's being accounted for the correct way and everything's being done correctly.
But then there are choices. There are choices of how to spend, for example, federal ARPA funds. You could use it to fund a teaching position, which then goes away, or you could do it the way you did it. Explain the way you did it and why.
I mean, I take it the same way that we take our free cash policies whenever we get any grant funding, whether it's the ARPA funds, the CARES funds, the ESSER funds, or whatever other acronym the federal government decided to give to another bill that they had. You don't fund salaries with one-time money. When you fund positions and salaries like that with money that you know is going to go away, you set yourself up for failure because that's money that you then have to pick up later on. And so by using the funding we received for capital projects and the one-time funds that we had put off for a while, the one-time projects we had put off for a while, it made it so that we could use our regular tax dollars and our regular general fund operating funds that we receive every year that we know are annual revenues versus one-time revenues towards our staffing levels and take that funding that was going to go out of that annual that consistent revenue, annual revenue, to those one-time projects, put that back into our annual operating costs. And that's how we've been able to invest in our people here in Gardner while still investing in our capital projects.
Sometimes it's just about making intelligent decisions. A couple years ago, electric rates were going through the roof.
Uh-huh.
Now, you made a decision at the time to go with a one-year extension or contract, if you will, with the outside company. That saved, following year when they went down again, you saved Gardner residents millions of dollars. How'd you know to do that?
That one kept me up at night for a while, actually, Warner, because we saw how much electrical increases were going up that year, because that was right when Russia invaded Ukraine. There was a lot of utility issues at the time. There was a lot of energy concerns at the time. The market was going all over the place. So I remember I was like, that's high. I remember seeing the initial number, and I was like, that's high. That's a lot higher than I was hoping for. So we made the executive decision to skip the three-year contract that we had always given out and go with just a one-year, just to see how we were like in a year. And if it didn't go well, then we'd go with what we had to go in the end. But there was just some, you know, talk that the market was going to go down once everything had settled, because everything was just so volatile at the time that we just needed to see where things landed at. And that's exactly what we did, and it worked out for us in the long term. And it was actually, if had we signed that three-year deal, it would have been financially just detrimental to the people who lived here.
How many residents are there in Gardner?
21,000.
All right. How many households, roughly?
Oh, that's a good question. That one, I don't have the number off the top of my head.
Approximately 8,000 to 10,000.
Yeah.
All right. So 8,000 to 10,000 electric bills.
And that's just houses. That's not even the residential. That's not even the commercial properties, the industrial properties, and other places like Haywood Hospital that are our largest employer but use a lot more electricity.
Each of them save 20 to 40 bucks a month with that decision.
Yeah.
That's how I got the millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So you literally saved them millions of dollars. So I know it's hard to grasp because it's not money that you're working with in the city, but literally it's actually true. Now, you also discovered some overbilling at one point regarding LED lights. Is the city getting that money back?
We are. I got to give a shout out to our city engineer, Rob Oliva, on this one. He was reviewing the electric bills we received for our streetlights in the city. Back in 2019, the city purchased the streetlights, so the streetlights in the city are our own and not owned by National Grid. And then we did an LED conversion where all the light bulbs were replaced from the former older type of light bulbs to all LED lights. And what happens in that process is the LED lights use less electricity, so we knew our bills would go down. But National Grid also has a separate rate that the LED light bulbs are billed at as an incentive for more people to use LED lights. And our city engineer was going through the bills one day because the payments were a little higher than we were expecting, and went through and realized in the fine print that we were still getting billed at the non-LED rate and not the LED rate, but the bills had gone down because, again, the just general electricity usage had gone down because of the different light bulb. So working with National Grid, we were able to get back payments back to the time that the LED conversion happened, and the city had overpaid by about $250,000 just the wrong rate being billed to the city. So we were able to get a check from National Grid back for that amount, and that's since been paid, and in the city's general funds, the city has been reimbursed those overpayments.
Mayor Nicholson, nobody likes property taxes. We all know that. But there are only a limited number of other revenue sources. You made a decision to opt into the 0.75% meals tax. Can you tell us about that?
So that was a proposal by City Councilor Paul Tassoni, but I did support it fully. And the reason why I supported it and signed it in the end, and it's actually something that's bringing in way more revenue than we expected in Gardner, is because there's only so much we can. We're limited by Proposition 2.5 what we can raise in property taxes every year. And even still, you have to remember that people are going through inflationary times in everything that they're doing. Their grocery stores, their gas bills, their, you know, filling up at the gas tank and everything in between. But having things like the hotel's excise tax and the meal's excise tax make it so that we're charging not just Gardner residents, but also those that visit the city. There are people who come into Gardner who drive on our streets to get to the restaurants. There are people who come into Gardner who utilize some of the parks and services that we have that don't live here. And so it's making it so there was a more equitable playing field in that we are having some revenue come in from those people who do visit the city at a rate that's still low enough to not discourage them from coming into the city, but make it just so that there's some parity and equity that's in there too. To get for every $100 you spend on a pre-cooked meal, 75 cents of that is coming to the city as your tax on the meals tax. Now, again, I want to reiterate, that's for every $100 you spend, 75 cents will come to the city. Now, if you're buying a burger at Burger King, you're not paying $100. So the impact on that is minimal. Even if you're sitting down at the Ale House or at Williams and you're getting a meal, you're not going to hit that $100 on per person sitting there. So the impact is really minimal, but we've taken in close to $500,000 in revenue in just the meals tax alone. And what that opens up is, you know, less of a burden we're placing on our real estate tax payers, in that we can cover some functions without having to dip fully into our real estate taxes that we have here in Gardner. It opens up opportunities for us to get on that backlog of projects that we have, to get on that strong financial footing that we have, so that we're not seeing things like we're seeing in other communities in the area or around Massachusetts that are looking for new creative ways to fund things that are require a vote at the ballot for an override, require a debt exclusion, require these various different things, because we've been able to come up with that short-term plan to come up. It's a short-term implementation with long-term solutions with it.
Okay. Expenses, revenues. If you can cut expenses, that helps too, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about Route 140 and your thought there.
That was something we've been in conversation with the state for a while. The state owned everything in 140 and was in charge of its maintenance and repair for everything north of Green Street and south of the, north of Winchendon and south of Green Street. But that area between Green Street and the Winchendon town border, the city was in charge of maintaining and plowing and doing all the operations for that. So we sat with MassDOT and said, why does this make sense? If you control before and after, why don't we give you back custodianship of Route 140 in this area? And it was just because it made sense. Why take care of just this strip with everything around it on the same street is done by the state? So we were able to work with the state and give them full custodianship of Route 140 so that that's fully under their control.
And that saves the city money.
Absolutely.
All right, now let's talk about the big ticket decision that you made a proposal to the Gardner City Council to go and get a third party firm to go after grants. Initial budget was approved for like 60 grand, spent like 50 grand of it right away, and then you took in just a little bit of money, right?
Yes. We took in quite a little bit of money, if you want to talk about it that way. We've taken in about $50 million since we hired grant writers for the city.
All right, so you spent $50,000 and you took in only $50
million? I think we had a great return on investment.
It's like hundreds of times the investment.
Yeah, yeah. It's
this does not happen.
No, but when you have the dedicated people who are there to do it, it's night and day. And the thing is, the staff here in City Hall have jobs to do. And if they're doing their jobs correctly, they really have limited time to go out and write the extra grant applications that are there for the projects that they're working on. They have time to oversee the projects that are there, and they have time to do the reporting for it, but the grant applications can be timely, can be cumbersome, so we've hired these grant writers for the city to take that off of our staff's plate so they can focus more on the fine-tuned details of their projects and really use that as a pipeline for the project that we have moving forward. So we'll send them the capital improvement plan. We'll send them the projects that everyone's working on. We'll send them everyone's goals to the departments. And then our grant writers go through and try to find those projects that are there and what grant applications fit those and work through those to try to get funding and make those projects a reality. And what that does is it creates new partnerships so that we have a pipeline that we can send those to. So if a department wants to see this type of project or programming or something like that happen, they say, hey, this is what we'd like to do. to Keller Partners and Company, our grant writing firm down in Washington, for them to just write it, and then if we get the surprise in the end, now they just have to worry about implementation, not worrying about how to get there.
Okay. $50 million, right?
Yeah.
What's the city's budget in a year?
Around $80 million.
Okay.
90 million, excuse me.
Okay. So more than half of the city's budget in 1 year, the city's taken in a grant. So how's that help the taxpayer?
Well, it gets it out of the city's budget. That's the thing, is that it's not like we're funding our city's budget with grant funds. That makes it so that we can get to those one-time projects. We can improve our infrastructure. We can improve our capital projects, our buildings, our roads, our sidewalks, our parks, our playgrounds, and everything in between. All of those things are things that we're now able to get to, one, on a more timely basis, and two, without diluting the services we offer for the city, because we can keep the general fund dollars that we have going towards those services to maintain a level of service that our citizens deserve, and getting to the capital projects that would normally be put on the back burner and bringing them back up to the front.
Let's talk about health-related items. When you came to the city of Gardner, there were a number of things going on. Haywood Hospital was going to propose some construction. There was Community Connections that hadn't gotten built. There was the lack of perhaps some additional dental services. Gardner needed a prevention coordinator. How did it all come about that you started on the road to adding different things?
You know, some of it's partnering with our private sector and nonprofit sector institutions and seeing what was needed. You know, Haywood Hospital with their construction and their finances, you know, that's going to be an issue. They just exited the Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is great to be able to see them leave that. And they've also expanded their services, having the new mental health unit that's been added, and that's been thanks in part to partnership with Representative Zlotnick, who's been able to obtain state funding for them to be able to have these opportunities that are over there. Community Health Connections, with the new federal funding that they received, has opened up their new second location in Gardner, and I think that's big to emphasize that it's their second location and an expansion of the services that they have in Gardner with their new urgent care, dental health facility, mental health counseling, and primary care facility over on Timpani Boulevard, on top of the services that they already offered at the Mary Kane building over on Knowlton Street. The prevention coordinator position, we saw that there was a need for that coming forward when GCAT was losing its funding, the Gardner Community Action Team, to maintain their own director. We undertook that as a city entity and hired our own prevention coordinator with Veronica Patty, who is the city's liaison to the recovery and other social service nonprofits that we have in the city, so that we have a ear for that here in City Hall to listen to the needs of those different various nonprofit organizations and community outreach organizations to see how can we help amplify their voice and bring them together so that we're more of a cohesive unit rather than everyone out in their own silos, and broke down those barriers so that we had that here in City Hall.
But when it comes to drug addiction, it's been fought on several fronts. For example, the police department in partnerships going after the criminals, the addition of Canine Rocky,
mm-hmm.
the drones, for example, that are very sophisticated,
yeah.
and other equipment. What are you doing differently that has helped those areas?
I think it's just providing people with the resources and the tools they need to be successful. You look at the police department, and we'll start with that. I mentioned in the previous question that I've gone on a couple search warrants with the police department just to see what they go through there, and I remember seeing some of the equipment just was old and outdated on the first one. So we purchased new equipment for them, including something called a TruNarc, which is actually a laser that you can point the laser at a bag of substance, and it'll tell you within a certain time frame what's in the bag. And what that means is that the police now no longer need to open the bag and expose the substance and potentially expose them to harmful substances like fentanyl if it's able to just tell you what it is through the plastic bag itself. And so that helps protect our officers and, you know, the work that they're doing over there. And providing, working with Canine Rocky, which was a grant that we actually used to buy Rocky, and working with his trainer and handler, Officer Willis, to make sure that they have the trainings that they need and the resources that they need so that they can be optimal. K9 Rocky was deployed over 64, 65 times in 2024, and he's set to meet that. I think he actually just exceeded that now and halfway through 2025. So the more successful they are, the more calls they get from mutual aid and other communities in terms of finding missing people, in terms of going on, you know, looking for substances on these raids, things like that, to give them the tools to be successful that way. And it's not just substance abuse and drugs. It's all aspects of the job, because you have to look at everything as a holistic approach rather than a pinpointed view. And that's really what's helped us out a lot.
Well, you've also done some collaboration. For example, tell us about the collaboration with the Opioid Settlement Funds.
Yeah, we've collaborated with our communities in the region to work with Gamma on a regional recovery coach coordinator. That's the wrong title, but I don't remember the actual title off the top of my head right now, just because there's a lot of stuff that's been going on. But by having that bachelor's level clinician work with people, they basically come up with a customized recovery plan. So that, you know, if we have a call for someone who's gone through an overdose, we'll let this recovery coach know. And they'll work with people to be like, you know what, this is who you need to call, this is who you need to talk to, this is what you need to do. And basically come up with that plan for them. Because when you're going through a situation like that, it's stressful enough. You don't need to... It's stressful enough, and we're blessed to be in an area where there's so many resources that it can be overwhelming to someone. So having someone be that calming voice to be like, I'm just here to help you out. I'm here to work you through you with your own situation. Let's sit and let's talk and let's come up with your plan.
Now, other situations come up, such as domestic violence. What's been added in that category?
Back a couple of years ago, we were able to add a domestic violence advocate to the police department who's been hugely successful. In fact, the caseload has gotten to a point now where we're looking at ways to see if we can make her full-time because it's something that just needs to be done here in the city. And working with the Voices of Truth, the Gardner Domestic Violence Task Force, we saw that the need was there, and we found funding in the budget 1 year to be able to implement that on a part-time basis, and Danielle Drew is taking that and run with it. She's been a tremendous resource for us here in the city, and I'm very proud of her.
The health and wellness sphere.
Yep. That's something that, again, our prevention coordinator, Veronica Patty, puts on each and every year. She's a member of the health department here in Gardner. Again, we're blessed to have so many resources in the city that it's sometimes easy to forget exactly how many resources we have here in the city. So to bring them all under one roof and make sure people know this is what's right here in your backyard, so that even if you don't need it now, you know what's there when you do need it, is the point of those events, and it's been really great.
One of the consequences of the new Waterford Community Center has been a place for the farmers market, which has expanded. Mm-hmm. With respect to health, tell us about what's being brought there.
I mean, anytime you can get locally grown, locally sourced produce, you know where it's coming from, you know what you're getting, and you know it, directly where what it is that you're, you know, buying. And that's great to see us that, not only for the healthy aspect of it and that people are buying local, less additives, less everything into it, people are eating healthier, but it also connects them directly to the farms in the area too and helps support our local agriculture economy. We've got around 55-ish farms in Gardner, which people may not realize, because when you think farm, you think acres on acres on acres of cornfields and everything in between. But I think our smallest farm in Gardner sits on a third of an acre, and it's a mushroom farm. And it's someone who's just, you know, growing food to help out the community and sell their produce. And it's great, and they're able to do that at the farmers market.
I want to take you back a few back years, back to the COVID vaccine and the rollout. Tell us about the recognition that Gardner got, and tell us about the collaboration regarding test kits.
So the test kit collaboration came from the... when the CARES Act was first released and the ability to purchase bulk tests was released, you could only buy them per the state contracts in large, large quantities. Quantities that we could use here in Gardner with our population. But when you look at places like Hubbardston that's got around, you know, a couple thousand, less than 10,000 people in population, that's a lot of tests that were just going to sit there and probably expire before they're used. So what we did was we reached out to about 13 different communities And not everyone participated in it. And in the end, probably around 8 of the 13 said yes. But what it is we all chipped in, and they wrote checks to the city of Gardner, and we bulk ordered these test kits, and they reimbursed us for the cost, and we gave them their share of those kits so that we could have these regional distributions of COVID test kits for people who were looking to test for travel, for work purposes, for just their own health concerns. And then we worked with the North Central region, too, to have our vaccine clinic. And do it on a regional basis. And then when the state reduced the number of vaccine clinics that were available in the state for efficiency reasons to really make sure that the resources were being used in the most optimal fashion, Gardner was one of those that stood out as one of the, quote, high-efficiency test vaccination centers because of the way that we were able to process people in the most effective and efficient manner through our public-private partnerships between the city, Haywood Hospital, the CAC, Mount Wachusett Community College with their nursing program, the Polish American Citizens Club for the location, and the city as a whole with our volunteer staff that we had for our registration systems. We were called out by the state for the quality of the services that we were able to provide, to the point where when you registered for a vaccine on the state's registration website, there was one day that the state system crashed, but we did not use the state systems because we had pre-planned and had our own system set up. And I got to give a shout out to our tech director, Bob O'Keefe, for working to set that up. And our emergency management director, Paul Topolsky, for setting up our call center for the people who were on call to register, because there was one day in Massachusetts where the only place you could register for a vaccine was here in Gardner, because we were the only place that did not crash due to the demand. And that's why we saw people from as far as Mount Washington in the Berkshires, and as far west as that place, and as far east as Barnstable and Hyannis on Cape Cod, because we were the only place in the state that was able to handle the
volume. Do you think they'll ever change the capital of Massachusetts to Gardner?
I don't know about that one. That one I don't know about for sure.
So tell us about elder support and ukuleles.
We've done a lot to support our elderly population here, too. You know, we've done a lot. I got to give a shout out to Mike Ellis at the Senior Center. He's done a great job of increasing programming for people. We offer ballroom dance classes on Monday nights for people who utilize the Senior Center who want just something different. There are ukulele classes now, as you said, that he's able to get state grant funding for through the State Department of Elder Services, or the recently new name State Department on Aging, just give people something different to do and get them out and get to socialize different. There's ukulele classes, but there's also, quote, open strum time, where you can just sit down and just jam out with each other on your ukuleles that are there. We also have a new tech library over at the Senior Center for seniors who may not know how to use the full computer system at their home, but they can go sit in basically a computer lab that we have over at the Senior Center so that they can work through the computer systems that are there, and then there's people there to help them out with that tech that's there too. We've increased probably tenfold the amount of services we've offered at the Senior Center. I'm really excited to see what happens next.
All right, so this is something that escapes me throughout all this, and it's a common thread. City over here has a Senior Center. City over here has the health list. City over here has a police station. There's so many elements in each particular entity that go on. Why is it that Gardner is excellent in every single category? What is the common thread? Are people trying to like outdo each other? What is it? Is it just do you get together and say, look, we want to do the best at this and that? How do you come up with all this stuff?
It's the team. And that's why if you notice in a lot of my answers that I've given, I've got to give shout outs to the team. And nothing I do here is in a silo. Yeah, you're the coach, but yeah, you're also on the team at the same time. We meet regularly as a full group of with the department heads, and then smaller groups on a weekly basis and a monthly basis to make sure everything's going the right way. And one of the things that I keep emphasizing, and I've emphasized it from the first day I took office, is no one's going to be in a silo anymore. And people are going to collaborate with each other, and people are going to know what each other's doing, so that if we can collaborate with each other, let's do it now, so we're not, one, doing the same thing in two different places in a way that we're only getting a 50% result if we can do it together and get a 100% result. And that's what we've been able to do to make sure that we're giving people the quality of service that they deserve.
All right, let's talk about parking. You come into town, you recognize there's more parking needed. So tell us about the locations of parking and what do you see the future of parking in Gardner to be?
Locations, we do have several city lots. We have the Knowlton Street lot behind City Hall. We have the Nichols Street lot behind the Ale House, between the Ale House and the Gardner Eagles. We have the Uptown lot next to the old LaGrasse's by the Uptown Rotary. There is the West Street parking lot across the street from the Gardner Ale House. There's the Pleasant Street lot at the Gardner Senior Center. There are a lot of different public parking lots that are free. We also are currently working on the new rear Main Street parking lot that'll have a parking lot, event plaza, grass space, and food truck court. That's set to be done by the end of the calendar year. We do need more parking, especially with the new housing development that we're seeing in the downtown, we're seeing in other locations. The city was one of only three communities in Massachusetts, and it was Boston, Salem, and Gardner that received what's called a RAISE grant. I forget the acronym that RAISE comes from, but it's a DOT grant that was given out for infrastructure improvements. And what that's doing is doing a full engineering study of a new four-story parking garage over the West Street parking lot. And that, again, that's the lot across the street from the Gardner Ale House. And seeing what that would cost, what it would be designed as, and basically making the blueprints for it so that if we ever do get grant funding to build the garage itself, how would it be built, but also what's the sustainability plan for maintenance of that garage. That'll get us another 200 parking spots if we're ever able to do that as well. So there is a plan in place to try to increase things. It's just how do we get there? And I think that's the program that we're working on right now.
A few years back, the Gardner Elementary School had been built, mm-hmm. and there were needs at the middle school, there were needs at the high school. What's happened since?
Well, the elementary school has been built and is in full operation right now, so it's great to see that our students are there learning in a 21st century learning environment. In the first school that's been designed and constructed for elementary school students since the early 1900s when Prospect Street School was built. But, you know, if you look at Waterford Street, it was built originally as the middle school. If you look at Helen May Sauter and Elm Street School, those were originally built as Gardner High School and Mount Wachusett Community College. So this was the first elementary school designed as an elementary school for well over 100 years. The middle school, we've installed new lockers, so our students can actually utilize the lockers that are over there. Additionally, we're doing some work right now to replace the storefront and the roof at the middle school. Over at the high school, there's been a lot of work done to renovate Landry Auditorium. To make it so that it's a more feasible space with better acoustics. The Chance Gymnasium's had a full redo over there, too. We're working on replacing the stair treads and the locker rooms at the high school, too, improving our athletic facilities. We've improved the practice fields and made it so that they're a little more level and easier to practice, and installed the new varsity baseball field over at Gardner High School and made improvements to that. There's the new storage shed and snack shack over at Watkins Field, so we were able to fully finish and wrap out the Watkins Field renovation project. There's a lot that's happened with our school facilities, and I'm really excited to see how our students utilize those new opportunities and kind of run with it.
Now, you forgot about the $8 million. The budget for the Gardner Elementary School had a certain amount, loans mm-hmm. taken out,
yep.
Came in under, so you had money to use, had to be 30-year projects. Tell us how that helps the city.
Well, that, again, helps us get through these capital projects. Now, the money's very restricted. By law, it can only be used for 30-year projects. By 30-year projects, there's different statutes and state laws that say what's considered 30 years and what's not. So, for instance, equipment is not considered 30 years. Paving is not considered 30 years. So it had to go toward basically building and facilities upgrades. That's when, I just mentioned the stair treads at Gardner High School, the locker room upgrades at Gardner High School. Portions of those are going to those. The new doors at the middle school, and the new roof at the middle school, that's been assigned to those items that are there. It's really, helping us get this backlog of projects up to where we need to be. And it's only been done because we were able to be financially responsible and watchful through just diligent work that needed to be done to keep the new school project as under budget as we could while still maintaining the quality that we wanted to. And it's been really helpful with us.
in the city of Gardner, everybody likes tech. They like their phones. They like their internet. What has the city of Gardner done with respect to expanding internet, expanding the connectivity in the city, you know, for the city itself, and then using tech to expand services for residents?
I mean, we've tried to expand access to tech, particularly with internet access. A couple of years ago, working with Congresswoman Lori Trahan's office, we were able to get Comcast to expand its services up to the Kelton, Stone, and Raymond street areas of the city. Those are the last area of the city that needed access to broadband internet, so we are now fully broadband in the city, which in 2020, to have any location in the city that didn't have access to broadband was just something that we were just behind on. So being able to fix that was great back in the 2020-2021 time frame. But also when our students were remote, we saw where people had access to internet and where they didn't, based off of when our students were able to log into their classes. And so when our students went back to the school, we kept that data and we figured out how was the best to use that to best plan moving forward. So, you know, working with Gateway Fiber, the new internet company, to come in with a new internet option for places in the city, providing free Wi-Fi through Gateway Fiber at Monument Park and the Greenwood Pool, and having that currently be under construction, bringing Starlink internet to places like the transfer station and the Gardner Airport so that people now have internet access over there, makes it, one, so people have access to the internet, but also, two, we can improve our city services there, too. We can look at things like online payments. We can look at things like online reporting, and rather than, you know, getting away from the handwritten paper stuff to a direct report. Working with our building department to use online inspection software through different tablet systems that we have so that the inspection report's automatically uploaded to our OpenGov permitting software with actual pictures from the inspection so that people can actually see what it is people are looking at. Working with the Code Red system that we make sure that people receive notifications as easily as possible. Creating the city's YouTube page so that people can see all of our public meetings and really bring more as much transparency as possible, because now people can watch those meetings at any moment, at any time that works for them, by just going onto the city's YouTube page. So there's a lot that we've done with technology to just increase what we're doing.
In the public safety area, with respect to the police department, the fire department, with respect to issues in the department, like policy issues, staffing, equipment, proactive public education, and safety, what has been done there?
A lot. Do you mind repeating the question, Warner? Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. With respect to public safety in the city, when it comes to the police department, the fire department, various issues, staffing, equipment, and then the proactive publication, the proactive public education and interaction, what has happened in the last few years?
I mean, there's been a lot for sure. If you look at the police department, I'm going to start with them. We're just about back at full staffing. There's been some changes that we've made in terms of removing the police department out of civil service so that we can hire directly from places like the Fitchburg State 4+1 program in criminal justice, which means, you know, it saves the city money and that we're not sending people to the police academy because they're already academy trained through those programs. But it also makes it so that we can direct hire people from the area. We were seeing a drop significantly in the number of local candidates who were taking the civil service test. And so by being able to direct hire, we get a more localized police department, a more trained police department. And we're getting that department out there further into the public. We have the Junior Police Academy in the summertime where people who are interested, students who are interested in potentially becoming police officers in the future or learning more about the field, can work for a certain period with the police officers at Gardner PD to see, you know, how, what it's like to be a police officer and what they work with and work hand in hand with the police department. We do that also with our Senior Citizens Police Academy and our regular Police Citizens Academy, where anyone of any age can basically go see what that work is like there too. We're also increasing our outreach. Again, got to give a shout out to Lieutenant Chesnowski and his team, Officer Spain, Officer Latteroot, with the programming they're doing with our students in the school, with programs like the Elk Safety Day and everything like that, where they're bringing the police department out in the community and having the, they call it the coffee with a cop hours at the various different places around the city, be it with the Gardner Housing Authority or the Senior Center. One year we did pool party with the police, where the state police dive team came out and did a demonstration at the Greenwood Pool, making it so people know what services are offered and also so the police department can interact directly with the members of the public. At the fire department right now, we are also back on track for full staffing with the people we've had in the academy. But we've also got our SAFE program, the SAFE, the Student Awareness of Fire Education classes. We've also expanded that now to a Senior SAFE program, which is where we do fire safety programming for our senior citizens in terms of upkeep of your smoke detectors in your home. Different resources to have if you have an accident and you can't reach a phone. Is there a button that you can call, push or something like that? That's really what we do with all of those things. We've updated a lot of our fleet, if you will, with the fire and police as well, with new hybrid cruisers at the police department and a new ambulance, rescue truck, engine, and a new ladder truck on the way at the fire department. The roof has been replaced at the fire department, where it used to rain more inside than outside on rain events. We had the insurance company following a wind issue with the roof come and fully replace the roof. So now we're working on new insulation techniques to make it so that the building is more energy efficient. There's a lot that we've done. I mean, we've got Canine Rocky. We've already talked about at the police department, but we've also got the fire canine Sully, who is our comfort dog at the Gardner Police Department, Gardner Fire Department, that if you're dealing with a stressful emergency situation like that, sometimes people just need to get their mind off of something, and that's where Sully comes in. We've got a new comfort dog at Gardner Elementary School that the Rockwell Committee was able to fund that just got put into service at Gardner Elementary School recently, too. So there's a lot that we've been able to do to work towards that, and then working with our schools on our drills that we run, our fire drills, our active shooter drills, our even working right now with our master plan on a municipal vulnerability preparedness plan, that in these emergency situations, if this were to come up, how would you address that if that situation were ever to rise? And I think, you know, one of the things that I personally feel the need to say is, one, I got to thank the teams that we've had at our police, fire, and dispatch, and animal control, and all of our public safety personnel, because we've got a really professional team that's really dedicated to the city that lives here, and they're willing to help people understand what it is that they're doing. One of the things I've kind of carried over with me from my town administrator days in Rutland is, in order to be a certified town administrator, you need to have taken a professional development class that all of your department heads would be required to take. So that's a tabletop exercise in which you're dealing with a hypothetical situation on how you're going to deal with this type of a situation that's there for the public safety personnel. And I remember sitting in that first one when I was in Rutland and kind of taking those ideas when I'm talking to the chiefs here and figuring out, you know, if we were to deal with a situation like we saw in Leominster with the floods, how would we deal with that? If we were to deal with another ice storm, how would we work through that? And are we set up in the best optimal way that if something like that were to happen, do we have all of the necessary resources and equipment to be able to handle those situations? And those are the conversations that we constantly have.
Veterans in the city of Gardner have gotten quite an upgrade over the past few years as far as services, to the point where other communities are involved as well. Tell us about that.
So we've expanded our veteran services department here in Gardner to have not only the city of Gardner serviced here in our veteran service department, but also the towns of Ashburnham, Westminster, Winchendon, Princeton, and Ashby, with another municipality, Hubbardston, also interested in joining, and we're currently in talks with that there too. And really what that does is has increased the staff that we're able to have in our veteran service department to make sure that we are covering everything we need and everyone has the services that they are looking for at the right time, especially when it comes to navigating things like VA claims or Chapter 115 claims, which is the veterans benefits locally for prescriptions, financial benefits, funeral benefits, and everything in between. Those are cumbersome processes, so to be able to have the professional staff here that we're able to do, to offer that not only to the residents here in Gardner, but to the area communities where that had previously only been offered on a part-time, limited-hour basis, now to make that a full-time basis that anyone can call here and get those services, it's really just it's not a moneymaker for the city. It's something to make sure that the veteran community has the resources that they deserve for the benefits that they've already earned as a thank you for their service. So being able to be that main force in the region there when it comes to veteran services is something that I'm very proud that we've been able to have here in Gardner and make it so that we become the veterans service hub for the North Central, North Quavon region, to be able to help make it so that anytime a veteran has an issue, there's someone on the other side of that phone that's there that they can talk to.
Mayor Nicholson, you've taken your legal hat and your legal training and you've put it to work for the city of Gardner in a number of ways, changing the city charter, updating it, city ordinances, administrative policies, various policies for the city, zoning changes, getting Gardner out of civil service. And tell us about all of that and how much of an impact that has made over the last few years.
I'd like to say it's made a very positive difference in that some things just need updating. The world is different than it was in 1923 when the charter was originally adopted. The world is different than the early 2000s when a lot of our ordinances were adopted. And everything that happened in between when we became a city in 23 and 2023 when we celebrated our 100th anniversary and where we are now in 2025. So a lot of it's just going through and seeing what still works and what doesn't and what we need to change to increase our efficiencies and effectiveness to get the best output that we're giving to our citizens in the end. So yes, we've taken a lot of legal analyses, a lot of operational analysis and feedback, and put it into practice. And what we've done is we've now codified it in a way that makes it so that, again, we want to show that we in the city are here to be open for business, for businesses that want to come in here, and actually put our money where our mouth is when we say that we're open for businesses and are looking for businesses to come. But also that our residences who are looking to call this place their home have what they need to make this place their home. And that's all of the things that we've taken into working with the city charter, our ordinance code, our policies and procedures. Is again, it goes back to people and policy and how can we get the best outcome for the people who live here.
We've covered this a bit, but tell us again, in the last few years since you've been mayor, what has the city done to expand city transparency?
We've done a lot. Like I said, we mentioned our YouTube channel. I've got to give a shout out. Again, you always, you never do with this anything in a silo, and there's always a team behind everything you do. City Councilor Elizabeth Kaczynskis is the one who started the city's YouTube channel when she was acting mayor. And that's taken off. And the views we get on that from people who are just looking to see what happens here, there's sometimes people who would have never had the moment to go to City Hall because of the time of the meeting or not even know the meeting was happening, and being able to just sit and watch it. The number of people who utilize the golf course who watch the Golf Commission meetings always astonishes me because they actually have a chance to watch them now. That's just one example, but it's the city council, it's the school committee, it's everything down to the development review committee that's there too. And that was one of the things that when I first got elected mayor, myself, at the time council president Kaczynskis, and at the time school committee vice chair Palavin, signed a directive from the three of us that all of the boards and commissions that met under our respective purviews, because I appoint most of the city's boards and commissions, the city council president appoints the standing subcommittees of the city council, and the school committee vice chair appoints the subcommittees of the Gardner School Committee, that all of those were to be filmed for upload for the city's YouTube page so that we could get that increased transparency out there and people could actually see what's happening. We do that with the agendas. The school committee now has their full packets posted with their agendas. The city website is constantly being updated with more information so that people can see what we're doing. These interviews that we do with you here, the interviews I do with WGAW on a weekly basis or monthly on WPKZ, where people can know what's going on. The mayor's updates that we do on a monthly basis now, for now. And we'll see what happens in the future. We got an award for transparency with the city's project map that's on the city's website that's currently being updated. There's a lot that we've done in terms of transparency because that's our main goal here in government, is to make sure people know what we're doing on their behalf. And we've increased it 100-fold since I've been here as mayor, and I'm very proud of that.
And it doesn't hurt when you get invited to the White House to talk about Gardner. And it doesn't hurt when you become elected the president of the Mayor's Association, which gives you another opportunity to promote the city.
Yeah, I've had a lot of opportunities, and I'm very proud of that. The being president of the Massachusetts Mayors Association and being able to work with my colleagues around the state does help boost Gardner's profile a lot by sharing what we're doing here in Gardner so that people are now copying us in several other locations around the state, but also bringing back ideas here to Gardner, too. Between being president of the Massachusetts Mayors Association, I'm a commissioner on the Governor's Local Government Advisory Commission that helps advise the administration on how the bills and proposals and initiatives that the Governor's administration issues, how they impact us here on the local level. We meet on a monthly basis with the Lieutenant Governor and the different cabinet secretaries to see how we can come up with the best outcome for cities and towns, no matter what the bills that is being proposed at the state level and debated in the state house. Working with Mart on their board as the chair now, soon to be, you know, I'm the only one who's currently nominated for the next term of the chairmanship for the Mart Advisory Board. Again, with Mayor Squaglia as the vice chair.
Gotta stop doing such a good job.
And just trying to figure out how we can get Gardner's footprint greater in the state conversations, in our federal conversations, and in our regional conversations. If you look at the bus routes that we've been able to get greater feedback and greater responses from MART, including the increased bus shelters that are in the city now at the bus stops, so they're not just open-air bus stops anymore, getting state funding, getting federal funding, because when we're able to tell our story, it puts the face to the name and shows that it's not just an application that gets sent in with the other hundreds of applications that people are reading, but actually know what's going on in the backyard.
You know, Mayor Nicholson, I don't know how Joe Rogan does it for like 3 hours. It's incredible.
I know, it's getting a little long here too, but
I do want to cover education because that's a big deal. Education. When you came in, people were still complaining about Gardner schools. Now, when you talk about it, the city of Chicago actually had a conference, and Dr. Pellegrino mentioned that of 40,000 schools, Gardner was mentioned. Now, tell us about some of the improvements in the last few years, like the curriculum, policies on cell phones, bullying, the partnerships that have been fostered, the construction that's occurred, the support for the music and art.
Our schools are where we build the future of our city. I often say that one of the reasons why I'm sitting in the seat right now is thanks to my AP government teacher, John Gardella, who our senior year said that we had two options to do for our final project in AP government, was to either intern on a local campaign and write a weekly reflection paper on the work that we did on that campaign, or write an 18-page research paper at the end of the year once the AP exam was done. And I took what any high school senior would do, and I did the internship rather than having to sit and write a research paper, although I did have to write plenty of that after for my degrees. But it really opened my eyes to what local government could do. But when you look at the curriculum that we've adopted here in Gardner in terms of adding financial literacy as a graduation requirement so that people know how to balance a checkbook on top of just your reading, writing, and arithmetic. The cell phone policies that's been put in place is being copied by many other school districts, not just in Massachusetts, but around the region and the nation, just to stop distractions from our students that are there. Bullying is always an issue that we're going to take to the forefront of everything and make sure we're addressing as best as we can. New partnerships for our early college program and with Mount Wachusett Community College through the early college program, but I do want to highlight the Monty Tech partnerships that we've had through the MVP program, which is where our students at Gardner High School who want to get into the trades and different tech fields that weren't able to get into Monty Tech can now go to Monty Tech every other week and take their shop classes. So they're graduating with a Gardner High School diploma and industry credentials through Monty Tech's program so that things could happen and open doors for them that were closed before. And by opening up those right now with electrical, plumbing, and carpentry, and looking at future expansion properties, we can get students into these tech education classes and that weren't able to access them before. We've talked about a lot of the upgrades to our school buildings with the Gardner High School auditorium, the Gardner High School gym, the middle school lockers, the roof, other improvements that are there. But probably one of the things I'm most proud of is our music and our arts and how we've been able to invest in those. Bringing back the elementary school band program. That was something that was a real, you know, priority of mine, and was able to do in the first budget that I was able to put forward for fiscal year 2021. Because in fiscal year 2020, the budget was, you know, somewhat set by the time I took office. That was one we just had to get through things because the budget was passed in August. All of our budgets were late that year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But getting to a point where we could bring that program back in, and now we have over 200 students participating in that. That's a third of the elementary school. And they're only allowed, you're only allowed to do band there in grades 3 and 4. So to have a third of the elementary school in a program only offered to third and fourth graders when you have pre-K through fourth grade in that building shows you how much the students are interested in that program. And we've already started to see the benefits of that with them taking home silver and platinum medals at the different festivals that they performed at. Our arts being boosted through investments made by the Williams-Rockwell Fund, particularly at the high school and the ceramics and photography and fine arts classes that are there, but also exposing our students to different arts opportunities. Like, we just sent the drama club on a field trip to go see Wicked on Broadway in New York City. That's an opportunity that some students may not have. So these investments that we make in our students in the long run really have been helpful, for sure, and I'm really proud of that.
And from a standpoint of achievement, Gardner Public Schools have gone from a Tier 3 when you took over as mayor to now a Tier 1.
Exactly, and that's because of the resources that we've been able to put into giving our students opportunities for success. Not to define our students and tell them this is where you're going, but to give them the toolbox to decide where they see themselves going in the future and set their own paths for themselves. And I'm really proud that we've been able to make that much of an increase.
Now, since we're getting low on time here and you've got actually other things to do, I'm gonna list some items, and then I'll have you tell me some of the things that might be important, then we can finish up.
Oh, okay.
The water and sewer improvements in the city, the focus on industrial space to bring more industry in the city, the increase in housing values, and the focus on bringing housing to the city, the support of nonprofits, the actual promotion of the city itself, both inside the city and outside the city, the focus on public transportation, including the arrangement with Woods, encouraging patriotism at various ceremonies throughout the city, and even your focus on replacing flags when they needed replacement, the endorsements and recognition that you yourself have received, the environment and energy focus, including the solar panels and the support of the Conservation Commission, and all the out-of-the-box thinking that you've done. Tell us what's important to you in those areas.
Well, that's certainly a lot in a lot of different areas, for sure. But it all comes down to the community in the end. And you take these jobs hoping that when you go home every day, at least in some small way, you made a positive difference in someone's life who lives here. Be it, you know, through the more reliable water system that we have, through trying to find new opportunities for housing for people who are starting to venture out on their own or call Gardner their new home, be it through increased housing production or through accessory dwelling units. Working with our city's nonprofit sectors to make sure that those in the city who may be struggling or those who are just looking for new opportunities have the supports and the systems that they need. Promoting the city so that we can get the new businesses into the area so that people have the resources that they need to make this place their home and not just live here but thrive here. Working with our veterans organizations on the issues of, you know, promoting patriotism, promoting our history, promoting, you know, remembering who we are as a community and what got us here, and that we were founded as a memorial to our veterans through our being named after Colonel Thomas Gardner, who fought in the Revolutionary War 250 years ago, to building that on our foundation to see how we've accomplished since then, and then setting us up for our future and making sure that we're more environmentally sustainable and have a stronger financial future for us in the end. All of this comes in the end to the fact that, as I said before, people are policy. Our job is to build a community that people are proud and happy to call their home and ready to make this their home. There's a difference between, you know, a house and a home, and there's a difference between a city and a community. And our job is to make sure that we have a community here that's ready to face tomorrow as strong, as stable, and as ready as possible.
Mayor Nicholson, you've made it through 5 fiscal years as mayor. July 1st, 2025 starts fiscal year 6 of your term as mayor. What do you hope to achieve going forward?
You know, there's still a lot left to do. There's a lot left to do. There's a lot of projects that are currently in the pipeline, and I'm looking forward to seeing where the next, you know, what the future brings us in the next fiscal year and beyond. There's a lot that we've accomplished to be proud of in terms of improving our infrastructure. I think that's going to continue. In terms of improving our economic development, that's going to continue. And I'm ready to hit the ground running and keep it going.
Well, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Warner.
Thank you so much.